Hello, guys. Welcome back to the Broly Talks Hockey Podcast. And in today's special episode, I'm joined by Mika McCurdy, who is the founder of Hockey Viz. And you've definitely seen his work on Twitter. How are you doing today, Mika?
I'm doing fine, thanks. Thanks for having me on. How are you?
I'm doing well. And I kind of want to get right into this here and kind of talk about how you got into analytics. Like, you're really big in the analytics community and hockey community as a whole. How did you kind of get into it? And more generally, how did you get into hockey?
So hockey in particular, I grew up in Canada, and so hockey did not seem to be like particularly important to me personally. You know, it was one of those things that was just in the water. It was there no matter what. And so I was surprised when I moved to Australia to do my PhD. So when I was already a grown up, I was surprised to find myself a lot more homesick than I expected. I loved it in Australia, and I have a lot of abiding affection for my 4 years that I spent there. But while I was there, I missed the contact with Canada a great deal, and I realized that I missed having hockey just around all the time. And so, of course, I had to seek it out myself, since it's not, you know, on television, it's not in the papers, it's not everywhere being discussed all the time. And when you seek something out for yourself, you get into it, you engage with it so much more seriously. And so then, and I was doing, I wanted a break from the purely theoretical work that I was doing for my PhD. And so I wanted something I could do, something that would scratch some technical itches for a simulation where I could make sort of kind of craft instinct, or I could make a little gadget where I could make some things. And so I started working on some just simple toy problems. You know, how many points do I think the Senators are going to take from their upcoming California road trip? And well, you know, one of those teams is a lot weaker than the other two. And so you start working it out, and you're like, well, I guess I need some sort of model of how good the different teams are. And then, well, if I'm going to actually understand the data that I created, I'm going to need some viz. And then it kind of moved from that impetus. Is, you know, now it's 10 years later, and it's that much more sophisticated.
And kind of going back, you got a PhD. For people who may not know, what did you get a PhD in?
So my PhD is in theoretical math, a branch of theoretical math called category theory. And it doesn't have any immediate relevance to hockey whatsoever. And I had to change careers. That's many people don't understand the why my Twitter handle is ineffective math, and it's a joke about how I couldn't get a career as a full-time research mathematician. And so, you know, in point of fact, it's come all the way around now to where hockey is, I think, the job that I prefer. And I enjoy it a lot more than, even more than I expected to enjoy the math career that I never had. But all of my degrees are math or math adjacent.
And going back to analytics, you started making your own, like guessing how many points the Ottawa's are going to take, like reasonable estimates. And when did you first kind of work on making your model? Like, what was like maybe a year or a season that you first started using your models and your vizzes?
Well, it depends sort of for what purpose. Like purely for my own amusement, as early as 2011. But then, you know, it was, and at first, of course, I really do think purely for my own amusement. There wasn't anything really you could show somebody else. It was more one of those crafts where the point is the doing, not the display. You know, I won't the end. And so then, but only a few years later, 2 or 3 years after that, I started putting some stuff together and pestering my friends with it on Facebook because I'm old. And then only several years after that did I even get a Twitter account, and which I did not connect with my then hobby of hockey at all at the time. You know, that was just a happy coincidence that Twitter turned out to be full of people who wanted to talk hockey with me. And so then that brought out a much larger audience. But that wasn't, you know, that wasn't why I got on Twitter. That wasn't why I started making hockey models to talk to people. I started doing it just to amuse myself.
And when was the first year that you released, maybe the first season that you released actually like Hockey Viz, like behind a paywall, and you were making money from it?
The paywall I put up. So it's funny, I joke that the website is kind of a dreadful mistake that has made me a lot of money. The dreadful mistake, of course, is that I created a website in the first place because I wanted people to have a place where they could go to to answer their questions about the stuff that I was creating so that they wouldn't just badger me on Twitter about it all the time. Because before I had a website, there's no way to get anything I made except by saying, hey, Micah, send me the Isles whatever Defender chart. And, you know, I would have to go dig it up for my computer. And eventually I said, you know, this is a job for a computer to do. But that was 5 years ago now, 5.5 years ago now, that I actually created the paywall on top of that. So, and it's been, you know, however successfully, it's been my primary source of income since then.
Awesome. And kind of going into analytics as a whole, what do you think analytics bring to the table that other measures of evaluation don't bring, in your opinion? Like hockey specifically, of course. What do analytics bring to the table that other modes of evaluation don't?
Discipline. I think the most important aspect that analytics brings is a disciplined approach, where you take the same approach to evaluating every player. Mm-hmm. It's so easy to fall into a trap of evaluating some players through one lens, where you say, well, this person is expected to do these things, mm-hmm. and that person is expected to do those things. And those expectations throw off your evaluations, because when you're evaluating people in regard to their expectations, then you're introducing all these subjectivity, because those expectations are themselves subjective. And mm-hmm. and so analytics, because you don't have that, you know, in as much as analytics makes sense as a single thing, I that's the notion that I coalesce it around in my own mind, that mm-hmm. that you're doing it the same way for every player in a way that makes sure that you're not partitioning people into roles that is artificially bending your analysis away from what's rigorous.
Mm-hmm. So would you say that analytics kind of takes away, or does its best to take away, all biases that people may have, and it just shows you what you're looking for?
Yes and no. I think there's a kernel of truth in that rhetoric, where there, you know, the bias of expectations being different for different players is a thing that, you know, like I just said, I think ought to be mm-hmm. taken out. I think taking a consistent, careful approach with every player, like a predictive model does, I think helps to accomplish that. Mm-hmm. But of course, it's not, you know, you can fight off particular biases or minimize particular biases, but you don't get to be bias free. After mm-hmm. all, you know, anytime you make a model, you're baking in the biases that you think are important by choosing to include those features in your model, and baking out the ones that you don't think are important by choosing to not include them in your model, even if you're then trusting a statistical method to weight the different gadgets that you did include. And there's so much complexity that's possible with any model that you can hide any number of gremlins. I mean, there's gotchas down mm-hmm. at every level. So I try not to be too grandiose about it, but I think you can eliminate or suppress a certain quantity of bias. And mm-hmm. and more than that, what bias is left, by virtue of the fact that you really ought to be publishing the details of what it is you're doing, you know, not just the outputs. You say, well, this is my model, these are the bits that go in, this is how I weighted them, this is how they came out when I weighted them using the data, this is how I accomplish that whole process. If you do that, that takes everything you did and makes it explicit to everyone who's reading your work. And mm-hmm. so then what biases remain are tangible, rather than hid behind, you know, whatever method of talking, whatever method of disseminating that you've chosen otherwise. Mm-hmm. And so that way of taking, that's good for biases, and it's also good for every other part of your work. It's good to take, you know, that if I was going to choose a second thing to, this is disciplined and it makes you do everything the same way. The mm-hmm. kind of next thing is that it exposes all of your thinking. And when that's bad, like when it's things like bias, when it's things like omitted variables, for instance, you know, people can come along and say, oh, you shouldn't have done that. It should be like this, or it should be like this. But even when it's good, it's good for the same reasons. Mm-hmm. That people can see that you're taking into account, oh, you didn't take into account this, and you can say, but I did, and then you show them, and then they know it's true. Mm-hmm. As opposed to something like, you know, when you're just talking off the cuff about some particular player, and you say, well, did you take into account his competition? And you're like, well, sure I did, or I didn't, but you can't, there's nothing to point at, there's no evidence, there's no there's no backup to that sort of thing where you can just argue for argument's sake.
Mm-hmm. And with analytics as a whole, like if you want to talk analytics, would you say it's a lot harder to have, let's say, a radio show if you're basing all your opinions on analytics because you got to have all that info right in front of you to show people? Or would you say it's not actually as hard as, let's say, article writing?
Well, those are two very different skills. Mm-hmm. And you can take any of those. I mean, you can take any of those things in any direction you like. And what is difficult to you and what is easy to you, I think, will depend on the person doing the work. I think there are some people, like, I mean, obviously, I work in analytics and I like it, but there are some people whose particular gifts towards storytelling don't really lend themselves particularly well to analytics, and which is fine. But more to the point, that like if the analytics that you're doing, if they're rooted in the truth of the subject that you're interested in, then that should pay dividends in applicability. It should pay dividends in terms of being useful to people doing all of those jobs. Like I think of my work as essentially infrastructure work. You know, I don't have a radio show. I don't write articles as a rule. I mean, the articles I write are just explanatory articles about my work. I don't write like feature pieces about so-and-so. Like I'm not doing journalism in that sense.
Mm-hmm.
But I routinely think of the website as, sometimes I like to call it a battery of writing prompts where it doesn't tell stories. The viz is not a story. The viz is just reference data. But it's presented in a way which lets interested people, if they're hosting radio shows, if they're writing articles, if they're doing a broadcast for a game, if they're trying to fill intermission time, you know, any kind of like meta hockey stuff, they're not players. It's not particularly useful for players specifically. You know, coaches are useful for players. My website is not.
Mm-hmm.
But anybody who's in the periphery, which is a lot of us, should be able to find something that's interesting, should be able to find something that's true, and ideally both at the same time, about the subject matter. And so there shouldn't be a real disconnect between anything you would call analytics and anything you would just call observing the game. I mean, because after all, it's just game observations one way or another, no matter how you package it up. So if you're doing it honestly, then you shouldn't see a huge distinction between, you know, I looked up so-and-so's stats and found his points per 60 versus I looked up so-and-so's stats and found his isolated impact on shot creation.
Mm-hmm.
And even if one of those is just, you know, boring and the other one is quote-unquote analytics.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And kind of moving on now to the analytics community as a whole, what's your favorite and maybe your least favorite part of analytics and the hockey analytics community?
I like the publicness of it. I like how it's all out in the open. I've never enjoyed working for particular companies. I've had academic jobs. I've had some private sector jobs. And now I have this freelance is not the word, this self-employed direct to the public job. And mm-hmm. that connection to the public, which is somewhat present in academia and even more present in my current work and hardly at all present in my old corporate work, like that public aspect is what's really satisfying. That feeling like I'm part of the whole world. You know, it's not a very big world. Like not everybody in the world even knows about ice hockey, let alone cares about it. But that world, such as it is, I feel proud to feel like I'm helping everybody understand. I'm not just making a buck. I'm not just teaching something esoteric because hockey is more popular than, for instance, the mathematics that I used to do. And so that public quality is the real appeal to me. And I guess for you know, and that's not just for me. That's for, like, that's part of what I like about the best parts of other people's public work also is that everybody else gets to see it. And among that, I get to see it. And so part of being part of that public conversation, you know, not just like me up on a hill saying, hey, this is what I figured out, and now all you masses can learn it. Mm-hmm. But also, you know, there's so many other people who are doing the same thing. So many other people I respect, and their work is endlessly fascinating to me, especially when you consider it in the relationship each to the one to the next.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess the as so often happens, the worst aspects are just a sort of a mirror inversion of that same thing. You know, that public quality, that discourse that goes in between people, includes not just experts, not just people I respect, but also people who are a pain in the neck, people who are poisoning the well, you know, for some more slightly too evocative phrase, but people who are putting out, you know, I don't want to say misinformation, but stuff that's awkward or stuff that's miscalibrated or stuff that's pushing a particular narrative, which is clumsy or harmful or just aggravating. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there would be, like, you don't get any of the gatekeeping that you get in, say, something like academia, or even worse, in a company where only a handful of people work and all of the benefits and all of the knowledge stays inside that company. But that gatekeeping can be nice when you're keeping up people who are causing problems. And so that's part and parcel of the same thing, right? You're doing it out in public, anybody can do it. And the people who are no good at it or are doing it harmfully are just as, you know, they can't be excluded in the same way as you could if you're saying, well, this is my little space and I'm going to decide the rules for it.
Yeah. And moving on to your view of the game, what was your favorite team growing up as a kid?
I wasn't a big, big fan growing up, like I was saying earlier, but I did cheer for the Senators, and to a limited extent, I still do, in spite of their many embarrassments, especially their extremely embarrassing owner. But my dad and I watched a little bit. He wasn't like a hockey mad guy. He didn't, you know, like when I was 6 years old, we were living abroad. He wasn't about to sit me down and say, you know, this is the hockey team I cheer for, and now we're going to cheer for them together. Like, you know, it wasn't that kind of Canadian story. But when I was a teenager and I showed even a little bit of interest in it, he thought, yeah, that's great. Let's watch the Senators together. And so we did. They were awful, of course, but way back then when I was a kid. But that was my main team.
Okay. And you said that you don't cheer for them as much anymore. Do you find it's kind of hard to have a team that you root for now that you're your analytics are all in the open, and someone could easily say if a Senator looks good, they could go out and say it's just because you're a Senators fan.
Yes and no. I have enough trust in my ability to sort of put on the work hat when I'm at work, mm-hmm. that like I don't, you know, like I was saying before about how one of the things I value most in analytics is doing everything the same way, and so if I'm, like, there aren't specific team adjustments. I don't analyze the Senators for work any differently than I would, you know, the Maple Leafs or the Habs or some other quote-unquote rival team. Or for that matter, a team that I, you know, sort of personally, emotionally pay much less attention to, like the Kings or something. Mm-hmm. So that, you know, that gives you a certain layer of insulation where you can say, when people say, oh, you know, that's just your fan-informed opinion. And I say, well, none of it is my opinion, really. Like, it's model output. It's, you can see exactly the process that I used, and you can see just how, you know, how impartial or not impartial it is. Yeah. But also there's another effect too, where just, you know, working, like when you constantly take that sort of global perspective, when you're trying to look at the league as a whole, you say, well, what about these players? And you're not just looking at one team, you're looking at all of the teams taken as a unit. Once you do that for enough years, it becomes difficult to consider one team special over the others. You know, the old affections die hard, and I still, you know, when I'm watching a game, I still prefer certain outcomes to other outcomes, and I still cheer when Ottawa wins. But you don't have that same, like, that same way of watching a game where you only really see what one team does. You know, every time you score, it's because you're great, and every time you get scored on it, it's because you suck. Mm-hmm. And you don't think very much about the other team. And so I inevitably watch both teams with the same kind of focus more, and that slowly pulls away at your fandom.
Mm-hmm. And kind of adding on to that, I kind of find myself, I know I've got a lot of time yet to work on this, but I really struggle with that, where because I'm from around Winnipeg, so I was obviously a Winnipeg fan growing up, and I've kind of gotten more into the Wild as time has passed. They're the next closest, so that's kind of how, sure, I based who I'm cheering for. But I kind of struggle with when I'm watching a game, I get really into it, and I kind of just look at certain things, and I need to kind of work on that and make sure that I'm keeping my opinion as impartial as possible.
It's actually quite tricky. Like, and so watching, in some sense, there's a real antidote to doing an analytics style approach where you're taking in the data in a way that's not watching. Mm-hmm. You know, where you're, and there's something really, really interesting there too. And not just about how it interacts with fandom, but about how the information that is present, you can take it in, you can talk to other people about it, you can do useful things with it in so many different ways. Like the sheer quantity of information is so large, and the way that that opens up possibilities is really fun. You know, mm-hmm. looking at what people do with video analysis, for instance, like that's every inch as nerdy as anything I do, even if a lot of those people have never picked up a script.
Yeah. So would you say, for example, like someone could be an analyst and never watch a game? They can just look at the outputs from the game, because the outputs of models, that is actually, like, some people don't realize this, but it's outputs from the game. It's the same that you get as you're watching. It's just actually right there in front of you. Would you say an analyst could do that without ever watching a game?
They could certainly try. And to an extent, you know, everybody who's working professionally in the space does that at least a little, because mm-hmm. people, you know, you're always putting out more information that you trust at a certain point. You know, you get familiar with what you're putting out, and eventually you do trust it. And of course, no matter how Herculean your efforts to watch, you can't watch the whole league, even though your model is inevitably based on data from the whole league. So there's always a gap there. And so you can get burned. There's no question. You can, because of course, just like your eyes are only showing you part of the game, you know, literally the TV is only showing you part of the game. You know, if you're watching on TV, you're only seeing a chunk of the ice, not the whole thing all the time. And even if you're watching in person, you can't take it all in at once. You have to focus here, you have to focus there. And similarly, so there's going to be blind spots like that, and you're going to miss particular things, just like we see referees miss calls all the time just because they're not looking at the right thing. Mm-hmm. And that's going to happen to you as well when you trust data work, is that there's going to be things that are missing. And you're going to see strange patterns. And if you were watching, you would say, oh, I see. That's because of, you know, oh, they put the wrong guy in the box for 30 seconds and then he came out. And maybe that, you know, you're not going to be able to pick that up mm-hmm. from data. So you can, you know, as long as you're willing to put your foot in your mouth every now and again and say, oh, sorry, my bad. And then mm-hmm. carry on. Like you need a certain humility to be able to do that. But as you say, the output that you get from models is just a version, a distorted, ideally distorted towards something useful, version of what comes in.
Mm-hmm. And moving on now to the off season and what's going to happen next season, which team would you say maybe had not really won? I'm going to rephrase it to, like, they exceeded your expectations of how you thought they would do in the off season.
Toronto did better than I expected, mostly because I fully expected them to sharply overreact to being beaten by a much weaker team in the playoffs. Mm-hmm. They had cap crunch issues like a lot of the cap teams do. And so they couldn't keep Zach Hyman, even though I'm sure they would have loved to. But I was half expecting them to trade one of their big pieces for a poor return, and they didn't. I was nervous that they were going to botch their goaltender situation, considering that I didn't know what they were going to do with Freddie Anderson. And I think they managed to improve their goaltending slightly. And so there were lots of rakes for the Leafs to step on, and it would have been very easy. For instance, they could have fired Kyle Dubas, which would have been a mistake. They could have fired Sheldon Keefe, which would have been a mistake. They could have made a big trade. Like, there were so many easy mistakes to make. And it's not that they sort of knocked it out of the park exactly, but they managed to avoid making any of those mistakes. And so many hockey team mistakes, not just the Leafs, but generally, are mistakes where people feel like they have to do something, and so they do, and the best choice is to simply do nothing.
Mm-hmm.
There were a few other teams that made smart moves, but I thought the Leafs were sort of uniquely poised to hurt themselves a great deal and manage to avoid that.
And keep going with that. Which teams, like, not really lost, but they exceeded your expectations, but in a really bad way this offseason?
I expected very little out of Chicago. I didn't think they were going to, I didn't see very many avenues for them to improve their team. And although it's been a mixed bag, you know, bringing in Marc-Andre Fleury is a big improvement. They, you know, he's going to be really good for them, I think. But all up, I think they mostly made their team quite a bit worse. Signing Seth Jones to that deal, I think, was a big mistake. They have defensive issues that I guess we'll see if Colleton has a new defensive system. But I don't think there's any reason to expect a new defensive system from him, and they desperately need it.
Mm-hmm.
There's lots of there. I feel like a lot of the moves that they did make did not help in any way. Moving on from Duncan Keith is nice. You know, that's helpful because I think Keith was also getting to a place where he was no longer helping. But I don't feel like on the whole they actually improved their defense, which is the most important aspect, the biggest weakness for them. And so there was a lot of, not perfectly sure what they could have done, but there were some glaring holes and they have not gotten fixed.
All right. And what was the best and the worst signing of this offseason? Maybe like some crazy steal or some crazy overpayment. I know you mentioned Seth Jones already, so maybe just go on to what you think the best signing was this offseason.
I'm not sure. There weren't any signings where I thought to myself, you know, people really should have been in on that. Like Dougie Hamilton was a great signing in New Jersey, but he certainly didn't sign for less than he was worth. And by all accounts, there were lots of other teams that were in on that. So, you know, that's one thing. Philip Deneau maybe in Los Angeles. That was I feel like that was a really good signing. It'll be interesting to see for sort of model technical reasons, as well as for like pure hockey watching reasons. I want to see what it's like when Gallagher has to play without Deneau, and I want to see what it's like when Deneau has to play without Gallagher. That's going to be really interesting because they have very different but very complementary skill sets. Mm-hmm. I happen to think that they're both extremely good in very different ways, and I think that's going to be fun to watch. In fact, Los Angeles, I think, is going to be fun to watch for a lot of reasons, and that's just one of them. Of all the teams this offseason, I think, I mean, not just because of Deneau, although that helps, but because of their prospects getting larger roles this coming season, I think are going to be really interesting for that reason.
Mm-hmm. Like I was talking to Matt Larkin a couple weeks ago about the Kings, and we went on about Byfield and how he should have a much easier time with matchups and everything because you got Deneau and Kopitar in front of you on the depth chart, so they're going to be taking all the hard matchups, and you'll be like just good to go. Like, do you think he can massively break out and win the Calder this season?
Well, win the Calder, I don't know. I mean, he would have to be up there on any sensible list of people you'd expect to be doing that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. I certainly think, you know, Kopitar is one of those curious things. He's been shouldering such a heavy load for the Kings for a number of years now. And they have, of course, been banged up a great deal, like in terms of like they've lost a lot of games in the last however many years. But Kopitar has kept that bleeding from becoming overwhelming. But age is going to come for him at some point, like it comes for everyone. And so, you know, it's not that they're like, I was saying before about how Chicago had a lot of holes and they didn't seem to fill them. Whereas in Los Angeles, at very least, you have a lot of players who you think, okay, you know, he could well fill a hole. Like he could do more than just fill a hole. He could become like a new piece quickly. And on the other hand, they kind of need a lot of pieces to hit.
Mm-hmm.
Like they don't have that much room for error, if you like. And that's part of what makes them really, really interesting to watch, is because they don't have a lot of choice except to give their young, really good players a lot of minutes. So even if they try to shelter, you know, that's the trouble, right? You can shelter people from matchups to some extent, mm-hmm. but if you really want them to make a big impact, you're going to have to give them a lot of minutes. And as soon as you give team people serious minutes, you can no longer shelter them completely.
Mm-hmm.
And that's unavoidable, just a fact of the better players playing more. So if you play Byfield, so like getting back to the point about Byfield specifically, if you play him to an extent where he would be in the Calder competition, that will unavoidably require him to play higher in the depth chart than you would like if you were just developing a player to become a big piece in a few years.
Mm-hmm.
But there's going to be a tension there, and that makes it fun.
Mm-hmm. And moving on to next season, who is a dark horse for next season, like a cup dark horse or a team that not many people are talking about that can make a good run?
Well, I guess it depends on who you listen to know who's, you know, who's being talked about and who's not. The circles I travel in might be a little bit weirder than the circles that you travel in, or mm-hmm. perhaps vice versa. So Florida, for instance, I think I think could really like they had the misfortune of running into Tampa Bay, you know, early last playoffs. I feel like they could really make a big splash. If Calgary, for instance, I don't know about a cup run, but I think if the play that they played under their new coach towards the end of last season, if that continues on, I think they could, especially in a very weak division, I think they could do, they could surprise a few people who, you know, Flames fans in particular seem to be pretty down on the Flames, which I don't entirely understand.
Mm-hmm.
Again, I don't think a cup run is sensible, but Seattle, I think, will almost certainly make the playoffs. I think they're going to be, you know, they're not, like, they didn't take a lot of flash, they didn't take a lot of scoring, but they took a lot of very solid defensive players. And almost all of their players, by definition, because they're coming out of an expansion draft, almost all of their players are going to get more minutes than they did last year. And that's very unusual for an entire team. I mean, it's just an expansion team phenomenon. But that means that there's a lot of possibility for breakout candidates there too. And they, like Calgary, have the pleasure of playing in a division which only has one really good team. Which is also true to some extent about the Central, you know, where Colorado is so clearly better than all the other teams. But none of the other teams sort of in the middle of the Central have that kind of like, oh, I don't know, maybe they could really win a bunch of games kind of appeal that Calgary and Seattle do to me in the Pacific.
And last question before I let you go, who are a couple players that you think are due for huge strides in the game or maybe a big breakout season?
Jared McCann is probably one obvious candidate. He's probably going to be in the Seattle top line, certainly in their top six for pretty much the whole season. He moved around a little bit. There was a lot of expansion draft chatter about him. You know, should the Leafs have protected him? Should the Penguins have protected him rather than trading him? I think there's every possibility that he could be very, very good this year. That's one obvious candidate. And like I was saying a second ago, Seattle is going to have a few more of those candidates because they're going to, you know, their entire top line is going to be people who weren't on top lines in the past season. The Nick Ehlers, I think, could have, he's starting to get the kind of attention that he probably should have gotten years and years ago, but I think he might have a really, really big year. He's going to shoulder a lot more responsibility this year, I think, too, unavoidably. You know, it's possible. If he doesn't, that would be a shame, like if he doesn't get the opportunity he deserves, but I expect he will. And we could see a lot more from him just in terms of minutes. And even if he doesn't improve, it will look like he improves if he gets the kind of minutes because of the way that we look at stats.
Mm-hmm. All right. I want to say thanks again for coming on the show. And where's maybe some more places people can find you? You can find him on Twitter at Ineffective Math and on HockeyViz.com. Any other places people can find you?
Well, for hockey work, those are the main two. The website in particular, people should know before they show up, the website is half free and half not free. The free half is more than enough to get you started so that you understand sort of what it is I'm doing. But there's a lot of interactive tools. If you want to like really dig into stuff, there's a lot of interactive stuff. There's a lot of extra historical data as well, if you like that kind of thing. And for that, you have to subscribe. But the website will walk you through that if you want to. It's quite cheap. And I appreciate it because the money goes to me for obvious reasons. Mm-hmm. But these days I try to keep all the hockey stuff pretty much either on the website or on Twitter. I try not to branch out into too many different places. Mm-hmm. So Ineffective Math on Twitter is the gateway drug.
Perfect. All right. Thanks again for coming on the show.
Not at all. Thanks for having me.